a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas. Death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Edwards to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for nearly half of all executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, Chief Legal Analyst Jim Skelton, with legal analysts Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell. Houston Vigil reporter, Jennifer Simmons. The Execution Watch for Harry Edwards begins. Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people?
Good evening, this is Ray Hill. I am the host of Execution Watch, which is broadcast on KPFT every time the state of Texas executes somebody. We have a report from Huntsville, which comes up first. Let's do this. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, Pat, what's going on up there?
Well, the witnesses have not crossed the street. We're still waiting for a decision from the Supreme Court. And as we all know, with the case of Dwayne Buck, we waited here to what, 9:30 at night? So
that's
we're
true.
Willing to wait.
Of course.
We do know that Clarence Thomas is the one that allegedly makes the decision. I think it's the law clerk. So we're just waiting on this innocent man. We are hoping that the Supreme Court does a little bit more than the Fifth Circuit did when they threw the case out on procedure instead of facts. That's when they threw it out at 7:30 last night. So we're hoping that the Supreme Court is reading that 181-page brief that they got sent.
Well, this is not the first time that Justice Thomas has been late in making a decision regarding a case. Just like in the old days, Texas cases went to Justice Scalia, who was pretty efficient about saying no, and occasionally about sending it to a larger body of the court to make the decision, but usually it was no. And so now this time it's in front of his replacement in Texas cases, Justice Thomas. There was one case I remember. I think it was the one that didn't come down until 9 o'clock. Ms. Scalia was late getting back to the building from dinner.
That was Dwayne Buck. And I'm hoping they read that brief. I read through that brief. It's a good brief. We know that Terry Edwards is an innocent man. We know that they had no evidence against him. We know that the other person turned state evidence, and that's how he got convicted. So, once again, I'm going to say I hope that the Supreme Court is doing more than the Fifth did when they procedurally, all they did yesterday was dismiss it on procedure as opposed to facts.
Okay, Pat, regardless of what the situation is in Huntsville, we're going to begin and do the show, but would you please remember to call, not necessarily into the studio, but to call Elizabeth if something develops?
Oh, I will, if we see the witnesses, but, you know, we're waiting from it. Elizabeth is on SCOTUS blast out list, and so...
Yeah.
We're hoping to get some information. We will stay here until some sort of a decision is made. Terry is alone. His family did not show up, and so we need him to know that someone is out here.
And the situation there, how many demonstrators, what's going on?
7, 8, 10. There's 12 of us with a film crew from WFAA in Dallas.
Yeah, from Dallas. Yeah, that's where the case originated. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you. I'll call back later.
Please.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that was Pat Hartwell. She's outside the death chamber in Huntsville, Texas. And the reason she's there is, number one, she's Pat, and she cares about these things, and she got a lot to say about these things. The other reason that she is there is so that we will know if the witnesses cross the road. Why that is important is the procedure is held up until the final decision is made. And tonight the final decision is with the Supreme Court of the United States, specifically with Justice Thomas. It is prepared on its way to the court because they anticipate these last-minute appeals over a long period of time. Give Jim a microphone. Jim, you can correct me if I wander too far off. Yeah, turn his microphone on, Jim. You can feel free to chime in if I do something wrong. But as I understand it, the clerks at the Supreme Court do a very good job of preparing these cases for the Supreme Court.
Well, what they do, by a month before any scheduled execution, they have what they call a death penalty clerk. We've nicknamed him that.
Yeah.
And what he does in any case that's pending within 30 days, he prepares a brief and lets the justices know ahead of time the issues that are likely to come up. So the issues are likely to come up are usually briefed to the court ahead of time. I need to correct one thing that Pat Hartwell said. She was complaining about the fact that they procedurally dismissed the case of the Fifth Circuit. What she failed to mention was the fact that a federal court will not consider any issue that was not decided and resolved by state courts. Everything in that brief had not been decided by a state court. And that's been the fundamental law for a long time. There's nothing unusual about that.
Pat speaks non-legal shorthand.
And also, there's something else. I've read all the opinions. There's nothing in either opinion about the co-defendant testifying against this man. It may have happened, but if it did, it's certainly not in the opinions. It was never discussed. So to my knowledge, the co-defendant did not testify against this particular defendant.
Okay, we've got another reporter in the field. Ms. Simmons, where are you?
Yes, hello, Ray. I'm at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd in front of St. Anne's School, and we have five people or so here. It's a rather chilly night, and we're very sorry that we're having to come out here, but I understand that nothing has happened yet. Is that correct?
The witnesses have not crossed the road, and so the procedure is not begun. There is apparently a delay in the final word from the Supreme Court of the United States.
Okay.
And our producer, Elizabeth, is on the SCOTUS blast list, so we'll know here, and Pat will call and verify that the witness is across the road if and when that happens.
Okay. Well, I would just like to say that people ask why we stand on a street corner in Houston for every execution for the past 10 years or so. It's because we interact with the public. We always have people come up. They're puzzled about what we're doing. They ask us questions. We just had a young woman from Georgia come up, notice our signs. She knew enough to know that Georgia was pretty bad at executing people, too, and we were able to tell her, yes, last year they were the champion, and we were number two. So that's why we stand here. We stand here for several reasons. the person being executed, the victims, the process, and to interact with the public. And that's very gratifying for us each time.
We'll give our regards to the vigilance, and we hope we're doing all this for naught. We hope a stay occurs even at a late hour.
Okay, Ray. Well, we'll be standing by, and we keep our fingers crossed for that last little bit of hope. Thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And now we can go back to Jim. The clerk prepares the briefs of the justice who will hear from that state.
Yeah, what happened, they alert the courts ahead of time on any issue that may come up. And the unfortunate thing, and these new issues brought up in the brief that was recently filed had not been brought up everywhere, period, in state courts or otherwise. Therefore, they wouldn't be briefed on that because the death penalty clerk briefs them on the issue. Because remember, keep this in mind, and people keep forgetting this, a federal court reviews what the state court has done. Mm-hmm. If the state court hasn't considered that issue, federal courts don't review it. And that's the way the writ law has worked in federal court.
And you've had a look at the brief that they filed with the state
court? I'm familiar with what they filed. I'm familiar with that brief.
So that's pretty virgin territory?
It's all virgin territory. Jack and I talked about that at some length, and Jack's only discussed that, what they put in this new writs that they filed in the Supreme Court. And there are issues involving jury selection, issues involving the claim that the Kirk was the one that did, Cody Finn was the one that did the shooting, and issues that were never considered by the state court level. Therefore, since it's not considered by the state court level, federal courts will not consider it unless the state court considers it first.
Wouldn't it stand that if those issues are accepted as viable, it means you go back and have a hearing on those issues?
There's a part that, well, the problem is we have a party, the case called Ex Parte Graves, and that was one of the issues when the Court of Criminal Appeals denied his writ. They denied it Tuesday. And in that particular opinion, Judge Alcala dissenting, because Ex Parte Graves said you cannot bring up ineffective assistance of counsel at the writ level. You can argue ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal, but not for a post-conviction writ. And they were faulting the writ lawyer for not bringing these issues up in the state writ. And Ex Parte Graves says you can't do that. And the reason is kind of a stupid law.
Well, let's go back. What happened in this case?
What happened in this case is that Terry Edwards was a 28-year-old African-American man living in Dallas. Had been in prison before, had been in prison, got out, went to prison on a theft case and a drug case. Gets out, he goes to work for a Subway in Dallas and starts stealing money and gets fired. He goes to work for another Subway store and starts stealing money from there and gets fired again. 2 months later, apparently he knew how the store operated. He and his cousin, a kid by the name of Kirk, his cousin, they go back early in the morning and go to the Subway store with guns and shoot and kill two people. They killed a 34-year man who's a manager of Subway, plus a woman who had two young children, shot and killed them, and made off with $3,000. What happened, they both left. A witness saw Edwards come out of the Subway. He had a gun. They saw him throw it in a trash can. And then what happened, he got caught that day. And later, Kirk turned himself in. And so what happened, you had a robbery murder, and he was the one identified as one. Plus, he confessed, but when he confessed, of course, he blamed all the shooting upon Kirk. But the question he couldn't answer is, how did he end up with the gun? And he claimed that Kirk did the shooting, then handed him the gun, which the jury obviously didn't buy, and they convicted him.
Yeah. And that's within the range of the jury's ability to decide.
Absolutely. Because one of the issues they brought up in the later writs that was never litigated at a writ level in state court was the fact that they had what they call a trace metal test, or they did a test on powder burns. Because when you shoot a gun, you have a blowback with powder. And they didn't find any evidence that he had handled a firearm, although they had a witness show him handling the gun. But you know, if you handle a gun after shooting, you get some powder upon your hands. But there are none, according to the writ, now whether that's true or not, they found no gunpowder residue. That was never an issue at the trial level, nor was it an issue at the state writ level. That only became an issue during the federal writs, which again was not litigated in state court. And what they're arguing is that he was not the shooter, and that the reason he got the death penalty is because the DA pitched this as though he was the shooter, when in fact his cousin was the shooter. And that was a big issue, one of the big issues in the writ.
What did Kirk get in this case?
25 years on an aggravated robbery.
25 years on an
He's still in prison, by
still
the way.
Prison. Okay. And So this case has been the full range of things. There was direct appeal.
Yeah, you got to. The trouble is, this is a hard case to do because there wasn't a whole lot to discuss. Because it's kind of like, you know, they had a pretty well solid case about him being involved in the murder, whether he's a shooter or not. They put him at the scene, and he admitted being at the scene. He just admitted the claim the other guy did the shootings. They got a dead cinch capital murder case. There never was a question about guilt or innocence. It's a question about punishment. And I think, and we're going to discuss this further with Paige, I think the major reason they gave him the death penalty was the death of the two people, especially the mother of two small children. And I think the facts of the case itself is why they gave him the death penalty.
And this is the Dallas case?
Right, came out of Dallas County.
If this case had happened.
And one other thing they mentioned, which really is kind of unfair, they mentioned that this DA that tried this case got fired later. But what nobody will tell, they didn't tell you, that the reason he got fired, Watkins, and when the new DA was elected, yeah, he fired a whole bunch of people, sure, just like Kim Ogg did. Right. And he was a part of that. So we don't know whether it was a political firing or for, we don't know that. But to say he's fired because of this case is an exaggeration, because he was fired along with several other assistant DAs when the new DA took over. So
yeah,
that was one of those things.
Transition from Wade to Watson.
Absolutely. When Watkins got in, a lot of those people under Wade got thrown out. And well, there was a kind of a real crazy lady before Watkins came in, mm-hmm, and all of them got thrown out. And he was part of that group that got purged. But that doesn't mean he did anything wrong in this case. There's no evidence that I could see in reading the opinions that he did anything untoward, other than he convinced the jury that Edwards was a trigger man as opposed to his cousin Kirk.
How did the defense lawyer do in this case?
The defense lawyer didn't have a whole lot to work with. I mean, what the defense lawyer did, he put on quite a bit of evidence in mitigation of punishment, because that was one of the issues they raised up in the writ, and they quickly pounded it back, claiming that he didn't do a good job. He put on every witness he could find. And here's the problem. Whenever you file a
writ, which is an issue we frequently criticize,
exactly,
defense lawyers for not doing.
That's right. But here's the thing. You can't just simply say people didn't present mitigating evidence. You got to present what they could have done if they had done it. And all they said is he didn't put on mitigating evidence, but never showed anything that he could have found had he investigated the case. And you have to do that. When you complain about a lawyer not doing something, you got to show what he could have done had he done his job, and they'd failed to do that during the writs.
The transcript shows that the defense lawyer did the best he could.
According to, when you look at the case, those are hard cases to defend because you've got a gut, sure, sense guilt of, sure, capital murder. And you got two dead people and one of them.
You got a witness of somebody throwing down a gun.
Throwing down the gun, and then. What do you say? You get up and say, oops.
In the interrogation, was anything wrong with the interrogation?
No. There might have been, but there was no issue made about the interrogation, because all he did, he was caught the very day of the shooting.
Yeah.
He was caught immediately after the shooting took place and confessed. And what he said in his confession, of course, that he was not the trigger man, the other person was. And I don't think the jury bought the idea that if you and I went to a place to shoot somebody, kill somebody, and I did the shooting, why would I give you the gun? I mean, they're not going to buy that.
Well, in the various counties around Texas that don't try these cases at all because of the expensive burden on, mm-hmm, the county, would this case be a capital case in, like, Harris County?
Probably not, because his prior record was somewhat minimal. Theft case, he got on probation for theft and picked up a drug case, got that revoked, and went to prison for a 5-year term on theft and drugs. And there's nothing particularly egregious about that. It's only this case that made it egregious. I don't think today it'd be a death penalty case.
Would the DA have to anguish on whether or not this is a death case?
Would they have to what?
Would the DA, would Kim Ogg, if she got this case tomorrow, would she anguish over whether or not try it?
I think probably not a whole lot. Because what they could try this, it's really simple. Try it as a non-death capital and give them life without parole and solve the whole problem.
Solve the whole problem.
And so it's the same basic thing. He won't be getting out.
Because if you have life without parole, you don't have the mandatory appeal situation you have.
Not only that, you don't even have a punishment hearing.
Yeah.
Because here's what's bad about it.
It's all wrapped in one package.
That's right. Because you get life without parole, there's no mitigating evidence to introduce. There's nothing to mitigate. It's automatic. And that's been one of the biggest complaints we make about death without life without parole, because you have no opportunity to present evidence to the jury that he shouldn't get such a harsh sentence. Whereas in a death penalty case, you have a punishment hearing. You don't have a punishment hearing in life without parole.
And doesn't all these extra elements actually weaken the conviction?
Absolutely.
And that's why we're here.
That's why we're here.
Yeah, that's why it's why the courts have been spending this whole
right.
week dealing with this.
Right.
Well, what have you assigned Paige to do?
Paige is going to talk to you about the punishment part of this case, and that was the ticklish part. Okay, Paige.
Anyway, in this case, Terry, who is our defendant, and his cousin Kirk went to the Subway store where Terry had worked about 4 to 6 weeks earlier and had been fired from because he had been stealing from them. And they went around closing time at about 9 p.m. And there is an independent fact witness who saw and identified Terry as being one of the robbers in the store, and saw and identified Terry as taking the videotape out of the machine in the store, and then saw Terry and the other guy, whoever he was, and that becomes significant later, whoever he was, get into a car, almost run over a sheriff's deputy as they're driving hell for leather away from the Subway store. It appears that Terry was captured very soon thereafter, and the witness, of course, has identified Terry. Terry ups that he was there, yes, and but then he says when he talks to the police about the fact that he wasn't the shooter. He's blamed it on a person called T-Bone, whoever T-Bone was. Now, the independent fact witness, of course, only talked about two people being at the Subway store at 9 p.m. that night when the robbery went down. And the robbery and the murders. In any event, so God only really knows who actually may have had the weapon, because the trace elements test on Terry's hands came back negative. I don't know, maybe the test wasn't done correctly, or maybe, you know, there was something faulty with the test, or maybe he truly did not handle the gun. Lord only knows. Unfortunately, Terry had been in prison for 5 years. He was paroled about 6 months before the events took place. And he was due to have been off parole in the middle of August. And these murders happened at the beginning of July, just after July the 4th weekend. So he had like 5 weeks left on his parole. But he was 26 at the time of the murders. And if he had spent 5 years in prison on the original offenses where he had the drug possession case and the revocation of his theft charge, and then had been paroled out, you know, to serve 4 years, he hasn't established a life outside that would reflect mitigating circumstances, and it doesn't appear that anything was brought up about his family situation or about his life before incarceration on the drug case. And so,
well, why do you suppose that? So the lawyer wasn't aware of any.
Well,
of that?
I'm just saying that.
Why would a lawyer not offer his life circumstances in mitigating circumstances?
They may not be mitigating.
I can't imagine other than they may not have been mitigating, but we really don't know that the lawyer didn't offer it. I'm just saying that the record of the appellate course in this case doesn't reflect any mitigating evidence offered in. And so ultimately at punishment, the only issue that was there involved future dangerousness. And the problem with that is anything that qualifies as a capital murder is per se imbued with future dangerousness. Someone who takes it in their mind to shoot and kill a cop while they're trying to commit an aggravated robbery. Somebody,
well, you got a double whammy there.
Yeah,
you got a
somebody,
cop involved and you got
somebody
a crime.
Somebody who takes it in their mind to kill two children under the age of 10 years. These are the things that qualify for capital murder. And so if no other evidence is presented, the very fact that someone is there, is charged with capital murder, has been found guilty, is a huge, overwhelming emotional and factual argument in favor of future dangerousness automatically. And so you're looking at a case where if you're accused of a capital offense and the jury has found them guilty of the capital offense, and they come in and all they have to determine is future dangerousness, it does not appear that any issue about party liability and party responsibility was presented at guilt innocence.
How long has this guy been on death row?
Only about 7 years, I believe.
7 years.
6 or 7 years, yes.
So this is probably his first sitting.
13 years?
13. I'm very sorry, I was 13 wrong.
13 years, and this is his, likely his first sitting. I haven't seen his name before.
Well, I really don't know, Ray.
He was a part of the lawsuit to have some of the drugs declared.
Oh, okay.
There was someone messing around. He was a part of an earlier lawsuit to have the drug cocktail declared cruel and unusual. So he's been bouncing around other issues, too.
Okay. So, he's been driving around
right.
Static issues.
This is not his
first.
He was part of a group of five inmates that contested the validity of the death penalty as administered in Texas because they said that the compounding pharmacies that were providing the pentobarbital to the execution chamber needed to be able to be tested. And so that was an issue as to the reliability of
I remember that.
Execution.
Actually, I held up executions for a short while.
Yes, indeed it did.
All right. The execution of Edward says has raised a few issues here. Where we are in Huntsville, Elizabeth is outside consulting her iPhone, but where we are here is that things were, at last report, held up in Washington, D.C. at the Supreme Court level. That's happened before. If we start a program and we learn that that happened, we continue with the program because there's not officially a stay. There could be a stay, and of course I hope that there is one, but if there is not, and the procedure happens between 9 and 10 o'clock. Now, Texas prison systems say that even though the window of executions is good for them until 10 o'clock, I mean until midnight, legally, they say don't tell us to execute anybody after 10 o'clock.
I want to mention something about that mitigating evidence, Ray.
Yeah.
It's only mitigating if a person has some tragic childhood. It's called a Penry issue.
Okay.
It's if somebody's come from a real horrible background, they don't hold him to the same accountability as somebody else because of the tragic background they go through.
If you have PTSD prior to the age of 12.
Something that effect.
Yeah.
And if you don't have it, you don't have it. What's interesting, in all the federal writs where they claim the law was ineffective, they only did that at the federal level, they never proffered any evidence that the lawyer overlooked, evidence that would in fact be mitigating. And that may have been the reason it wasn't presented, but they never, ever, in any of their writs, ever showed what would have been, they didn't present. That was never brought up. So the only assumption you can come from that, from looking at at the opinion in the writs, is that he did not have any evidence that would mitigate the death penalty. We wouldn't have a Penry issue submitted because he didn't have that background that's required to present mitigating evidence. But they did present witnesses at punishment. They just didn't present mitigating evidence. And maybe because they didn't have any, we don't know the answer to of that.
Yeah. Well, earlier, before the show, we were talking about Carl Napier, who returned from Vietnam with severe PTSD and a different mindset. But that could not have been presented as mitigating evidence, but it happened to a child as opposed to a soldier. It could be. Is that basically that? Well, all right, Larry, what you got?
Well, we were talking a little bit about the jury selection process. Now, in every case in the United States, the accused is entitled, has a federal right, a constitutional right to a trial by jury.
Yeah.
And part of the...
If it's a capital case, there's no avoiding
clearly,
that.
Well, in every case, yeah. Right to a trial by jury. And part of the right of trial by jury is a trial by an impartial jury.
Okay.
So Edwards raises the question here about whether there were not impartial, a particular juror may not have been impartial. But there's a procedure, there's a way to go about raising that. Okay, so the way it came about in the Edwards case is that in the process of jury selection, the judge gave a definition of mitigating evidence to three of the jury veneer men.
Mm-hmm.
And the lawyer objected to that, the way the definition was given, and then decided that he moved to have those veneer members disqualified. He didn't challenge them directly, but he moved to have them disqualified. Well, as it turned out, there were three of them. And so, and two of them were removed by agreement between the parties, between the state and the defense. So there's one remaining, okay? And again, and then the way that the jurors are removed is, first of all, you have challenges for cause and then peremptory challenges. Each side gets 15 of those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and if you want to complain, if you want to have an issue that's perfected on appeal, there's a certain way you got to go about doing it. You know, first of all, the court is not required to give you anything you don't ask for. So if you believe that a juror is not impartial, the first thing you need to do is seek challenge that juror for cause. And apparently this lawyer failed to do that, failed to challenge for cause. And in addition, if you challenge for cause, you've also have to use one of your peremptory challenges against that juror. He didn't do that. And if you use the peremptory challenges against that juror and you run out of strikes, then you have to ask for an additional strike. In this case, the judge gave him an additional strike. Now, I'm not sure exactly why he did it, but he gave him an additional strike, which he didn't use to challenge that juror. And then if you fail to do so, if all of those things are in line, and that partial juror gets on the panel, on the jury, then that is reverse. That's error. That's potential error. The step that has to go through is, first you have to assert that there was a clear and specific challenge for cause.
Okay.
And in this case, there was none.
There was.
Okay. There was a request that three panelists be removed, be disqualified, but there was no clear challenge for cause. The second is that he must use that challenge for the complained of person. He didn't use it. And this panelist gets on the jury. He didn't use it, and he has to use up all of his strikes. He used those, all 15 of them, but he's got to ask for an additional. Well, he did ask for an additional one, and the judge gave it to him. But after he asked for the additional, he did not use that to strike the complained of veneer person. So he didn't do that. And it appears that it was clear that the issue was not perfected on appeal. It appears that when you look at it legally, but in the course of the appellate process, it was something that was just brought up in the hope that maybe there's something there when there was nothing there.
And it proved to have nothing there.
there was nothing there, and yeah, that came out. It was an argument that was raised, and a lot of times appellate lawyers raise whatever they think might slow things down, stop things, what have you. But when you look at the way the procedure is laid out, and well, this lawyer clearly knew what the procedure was.
Short of something like an all-white jury after 250 black strikes or something else like that by the state. Do challenges in the voir dire system really work well on appeal?
The system itself, okay, is set up such that you've got lawyers on both sides, the state and the defense.
Sure.
And by the time...
And in this case, they agreed on two of the three.
They agreed on two of the three.
Or persona non gratas.
And the thing about all cases, but particularly death penalty cases, if you have competent counsel on both sides, there's a pretty good chance that you're not going to have reversible error at all. Now, you can get reversible error if you don't have competent counsel on one side, particularly on the defense side. But a good defense lawyer will follow all of the rules. And by virtue of his following all of the rules, there is not likely to be any reversible error, in which case it's more likely that the person will die. Now, competent counsel on both sides, lawyers have a tendency to try cases such that they don't come back. Okay, it would be wouldn't make a lot of sense to try to embed error into the record. You're trying to keep error out of the record. And so things like jury selection, the biggest concern in the jury selection is that you don't get a partial person, a person who's not impartial on the jury.
Okay.
Nobody wants that. And so the judges will bend over backwards to make sure if this person shows partiality, it's gone. Okay? And if you feel like there is an issue of his being partial, then the responsibility of the defense lawyer is to, if you can't get him, challenge him for cause to begin with. State the reasons why he's not impartial. And the judge will give it to you in most cases. If the judge fails to give that to you, then use your strikes. You've got 15 of them.
Yeah, 15 of them.
And if you use up all your strikes and you still think somebody's potentially on the jury who is not impartial, ask the judge, may I have another strike because I want to get rid of him? And judges will oftentimes give it to you, but they're not going to give it to you if you don't ask for it. Okay, in this case, I'm not sure which veneer person he had in mind to asking for the additional strike, but he got it, and then he's complaining about one particular veneer person that he doesn't use that extra strike on. He doesn't use any, the 15, it doesn't use that. And then he raises the question, well, I had needed to use it on another juror who was not impartial. Well, who was that? You've got to let them know, well, if I use it on him, then ask for another. And because you, in order to have reversible error, you have to move until you receive an adverse ruling.
Well, reversible error is kind of the atomic bomb in this.
Potential reversible error.
And we've had cases reversed that we've got ready to try. I got ready to do these shows.
Oh, yeah.
And we've had some stays that were durable, and we had some stays that resulted in resentencing, resentment, and all manners of things. In other words, we've lost some people that were in the line to come down and be covered by execution watch. And most of that deals with the appellate process and all of that. Is that as good as we can do?
Well, Ray, if you've got competent counsel on both sides, the process, and I think we're focusing on the death sentence, the death penalty cases.
Sure, that's what our venue.
In order for a person to be considered for the death penalty, okay, you've got to have death eligible jurors.
Sure.
And if they're death eligible, if they're death qualified,
they've got, in other words, they've got to tell the court, in the proper case, I can sentence somebody to be executed.
Exactly. Okay.
That's up front. If you can't say that, you're not going to be on that jury.
And the way the statute is constructed, Ray, there's a real good chance, and particularly when the kinds of cases that are selected for the execution, for the application of the death penalty, it's almost a foregone conclusion that the district attorney, and I talk about this a lot, about the discretion that they have. If they decide they want to kill somebody, okay, and the facts warrant it, they can typically get a death sentence. And on a routine basis, the thing that saves a person who is accused is, it's unfortunate to think this way, but if the counsel is not a competent counsel and screws it up some sort of way, that's about the only out. But if a person is death eligible, when you go through this system, it's really almost automatic. And particularly when you talk about the fact that the future danger can be found from the facts of the case. Well, if you do things like killing two and three people in the same episode, or the list that Paige just went through, it's that in and of itself can be considered for someone who has no prior criminal history whatsoever.
We've been through that several times because we had the Candyman, who had never committed so much as a traffic ticket, as far as we know, poisoned his own kids on Halloween. That was sufficient. Mm-hmm. That was sufficient for them to say he's future dangerous. Well, he didn't have any more kids to kill. Well, that kind of eliminates that. He didn't get the insurance money, so it didn't work. And so, but they still executed him and said he was future dangerous. And, maybe to Pentecostal congregations, that's where he hung out, but not to the rest of us.
But, Ray, the structure of the statute is such that these kinds of cases are likely to result in death.
Yeah.
If they are tried by competent counsel on both sides, the structure of the statute pretty much makes it pretty close to inevitable.
Thank you, Larry.
Yes, sir.
Jim?
I want to mention to kind of clarify.
Sure.
The way it works, a statute gives you specific reasons to challenge somebody for cause. If you quote the statute and give a specific reason, the judge will grant it.
Put all that on the record.
That's right.
The
problem comes in, we call a vacillating juror, where they talk to the prosecutor and say, I will do it, talk to the official, and they can't do it. It's called a vacillating juror. Then it's to the discretion of the judge, and that was about the judge's discretion. One thing that I would contradict, number one, defense lawyers try to build in error in the record. They don't want, and if they don't want a case to come back, that's simply not true. Lawyers, one of the things they try to do is error. Now, the state doesn't want error in the record, but the defense lawyer does.
I've been down clear to Bay City in the Billy Hughes third trial,
mm-hmm.
and we could see from the day beginning that Alan Stille had greased the rails for Billy to go back to death row. That was a done thing. And the lawyers on that case were my lawyers. It was Mike Maness
and they worked to build.
And they built in error. Because in the first place, they knew Alan Stille probably didn't know he was allowing error in the case.
Well, I know. I've worked with Alan Stille, and believe me, he's not a Cocker Spaniel.
He's not the brightest porch light on the block. So that was easy doing.
Right.
Of course, Billy was executed.
Gotcha.
Hey, Mike, what's going on?
What's going on is I'm here to talk about the way we execute people. We are now in the process of executing another man by lethal injection. I want to go back a bit in time and understand that there are many ways to execute people.
Sure.
For ages, we'd shoot them.
Yeah.
We'd hang them.
Yeah.
We'd behead them.
Yeah.
Now, we poison them.
Yeah.
The issue is, no matter what a man did, And even he might deserve to die, does he deserve to die humanely, without pain, without suffering?
Well, isn't that a contradiction of thing, a humane death? Doesn't that come up as an...
I think if we're a Christian society, justifying what we do, we have to be humane. Putting somebody down...
Well, if you see a suffering dog, all right, that is going to die anyway...
Prime example.
You can take them out of their pain. If your horse breaks his leg and out on the prairie, you can't fix it, so you pull out the pistol, you resolve the issue. But Mike, I have a hard time accepting the thesis that you take an otherwise healthy human being, strap them to a thing and killing them, and call that humane.
Well, that's why we're here.
Yeah.
And we all agree with that. And in fact, I've said this before, but in my experience, life in prison with no parole is more hard on a prisoner than death. Death prisoners can accept, but life in prison with no parole is a horrible punishment. With that said, we're here because we don't agree with the death penalty.
You're right.
What we're here to talk about is if we're going to execute him, how to do it in a humane way. The issue right now is, does a man suffer? We have always, once we got to this point of using drugs, and my personal opinion is the reason we're using drugs now is not to be humane to the prisoner, it's to be humane to the gods. Beheading is nasty.
Yeah.
Hanging is nasty.
Yeah, but
shooting is nasty.
Nazi Germany learned that putting people at the pit and shooting them has an effect on the shooters.
Yeah. In fact, we believe that in states like Utah that still has an option to shoot, they give certain of the executioners live rounds and one gets a blank. And the
One bullet kills and the rest.
I've heard it both ways.
Yeah, it doesn't make any difference, but they give you a psychological out.
Exactly right. And let's talk about humane way to execute people. The most humane way is beheading. Like that, it's over.
It's over, yeah.
But it's a messy cleanup job for the gods.
Yeah. It's a mess.
Shooting is a mess. We like to do execution nice and clean. The problem is we've been using a drug for years to do this, but that drug now is no longer available, as we've talked many times before.
Yeah.
That drug, for some reason, we cannot find in America. We have to go overseas. And just recently, I've heard that certain branches of the government have stopped the drugs from coming in because technically, under the law, there's no use for these besides killing people, so there's no purpose to bring them in.
Yeah.
Well, that's why we want them in here. So as a result, we now have a new type of drug that's causing all this controversy. And this is a three-part drug. And these three-part drugs, to be kind to the person, does three things. The first drug sedates him. The second drug paralyzes him. And the third drug kills him. The problem is what the cases have shown, the news has shown, that since this new drug has come out, that the first drug ain't working. When you have prison officials testifying in court that it's taken 12 to 15 minutes to people die, just even before the second or third come in, that they're struggling, they're pulling, they're not sedated. And all of a sudden, we're not being humane. We're being cruel. Just today, 3 hours before this show, the Chicago federal courts, doesn't affect us, but Chicago federal courts stopped three executions in Chicago today for this very reason.
Well, do you think that put a ripple in the pond that may affect this case?
I can't imagine how it can't, but technically it doesn't affect us. But you gotta feel that if a
jurisdictionally
federal,
it doesn't
yeah,
affect
but
it.
If a federal and the opinion is real strong for these very reasons, and the state even offered that we will multiply times 50 that first drug to make sure he's sedated, and they say that's not good enough. And of course, one of the problems is how do you test it? How do you find out if it bothers somebody because they're deceased? We have to find a more humane. If we're going to execute people, which none of us believe we do, we should. But if we do, we have to find a more humane reason way to do it. I've got a concept that makes no sense, but the most humane way is kill them in their sleep. If somebody
slip up on
if somebody slip, it's sentenced to die. He's in there every night. Every night he goes to sleep not knowing he's going to wake up. But when it comes, there's no pain, there's no apprehension.
Well, Mike, let me think about that.
It's not it's something we can't do.
Suffocation is pain.
Yeah, but...
But when I talk, we're talking about execution in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Okay, you never wake up from it.
Well, they like to execute in the middle of the night. You notice that.
Yeah, but they like the man to sit there and know what's coming and think about it and strap him down and slowly give him the drugs.
You see, what you're taking away from it is the ritualization of killing. And it's been my theory all along that actually an execution is a religious process that has been ritualized. They write down what he had for breakfast. They write down how many times did he fart all day. They write down what he had for lunch. They write down what he wanted, whether he got it or not for supper. They write down when he went to sleep. They write down when he got up. They write down when he saw the chaplain. It is the preparation of a homily about a ritual.
So based upon that, I should keep a diary of my girlfriend to justify my affairs. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Either you're Christian and you're fair, and again, we do not believe in killing people, but as a Christian society, we decided to do it. The question is how to do it humanely. And I got to tell you, the way they did in the old days was pretty quick, but it's messy.
Yeah,
My issue is, are they trying...
War is messy. It's frequently not...
Are they
quick,
trying to protect the guards or the inmate?
Yeah.
They're doing these things so the guards ain't messy, but the man is suffering.
As usual, Mike has brought to the table things to think about. Let's see what Jack's got to offer, because we're running out of this hour, and I can point out that at this point, we do not know whether witnesses are crossing the road. No witnesses across the road. My producer tells me that has not happened.
No word from
the Supreme Court. Thomas probably drank too much wine and can't safely drive back to the court. Jack, you got off on a sabbatical the last time we did this.
Yeah, I did. I didn't kill myself, not for lack of trying.
Okay.
I wanted to touch upon something that Jim had talked about, the Graves case. Graves basically says that you are entitled to a fair trial, but you are not entitled to a writ. You're not entitled to a clean process in the appeals in the writ process.
The trial has to be fair.
That's correct.
The writ stuff. Not so much.
That's correct. Because appeals and writs and things like that, these are statutory. They're not constitutional. On the other hand, you have a constitutional right to a fair and speedy trial. These are built into the Constitution, and as a result of that, if there's an error in the trial process, well, you have a constitutional right to have that fixed. On the other hand, if there's a problem, your writ lawyer missed something,
yeah.
Well, that's too bad. you don't get to appeal a writ. You don't get to appeal an appeal. For an error that happened in the appeal. You can go back and say, well, something happened wrong at trial, and at this level, let's say on the state level, they denied you relief. You can appeal that decision about what happened on the trial level, but you don't get to appeal what your appellate attorney did.
How much of that is built into the rules themselves? I mean, in this particular case, we're talking about issues brought up in the route to the Supreme Court.
Right.
And wait a minute. Was not this defendant entitled to these issues being raised earlier? And if they were not raised earlier, do the rules themselves waive their serious consideration?
If you didn't raise it on the trial level, you've waived it. And that's it.
I get some feedback here.
let me kind of jump in here just a second. What really, it's not a question of not having an ear and a writ. What the law says is that you cannot bring up a lawyer being ineffective on a writ. That's what the Graves said.
Okay.
And the reason they argue that, you can't bring that point up. You can bring an ineffective point on direct appeal, but you cannot later in a writ claim your writ lawyer was ineffective by filing a subsequent writ. And the problem you've got, Ray, is real simple. When you file a state writ, all the federal writ does is simply look at the state writ, and if it was not considered at the state level, the federal writ says procedural default. They will not consider any issue that was not raised at the state level in a state writ or on direct appeal. And that's a problem with the stuff that they complained about in this case, is that new brief they filed in the Court of Criminal Appeals contained issues that were not discussed on the state level. Therefore, that's why the Fifth Circuit said we're not going to consider it. It's called procedural defaults, a law word, the law phrase they use.
So the rules.
Rules is a statute when they pass a...
Okay, now I understand the difference between statutory and constitutional.
Right.
And I know the constitutional is thrown in some things that said you've got to have a fair and speedy trial and you're entitled to a jury of your peers and an impartial jury of your peers, and I can understand all of that. I need some going out papers. I need the write-up if somebody's got a copy of it handy. And so the deal is that what we have to deal with here is are the rules about what issues you can raise, compressing the possibility for an enduring right to fairness all the way to the Supreme Court?
Answer that is no, because what happened, Congress passed a statute that said when the federal court considers a state writ, when they appeal a case in the federal court, they ask two questions. Did the court below, meaning the state court, did the court below render a decision based upon, as long as it's not contrary to the Constitution, they're going to affirm it. So what they simply do is look at the decision done at the writ level, and what they basically say is that we're going to only consider it if it's a violation of the Constitution. If it isn't, then they're going to affirm the case.
Okay. This has been an interesting discussion. We were worried about whether we had enough material to make one interesting discussion. We walked in the room, but apparently it was there. My name is Ray Hill, and I am the host of Execution Watch. I don't enjoy this job. I don't particularly like the show, but I think there's a journalistic obligation to do the show. I certainly don't do it alone. The show is actually put together by the producer, Elizabeth Stein, and she puts in a good many hours, and she's been working throughout the show trying to figure out what the hell's going on at the Supreme Court that's holding up this execution. We don't know. At this point, all we know is that no witnesses have crossed the road. The execution procedure has not begun. It may begin later tonight, and you will read about it in Mike Grazik's column in the Houston Chronicle or over the Associated Press wires in the morning. I want to thank the legal team, which includes Jim Skelton as kind of chief researcher of the group, a page. And Larry and Mike and Jack, who's back with us after a time off to have a good time. And I want to thank the reporters in Huntsville, Pat Hartwell. And thank you, Pat, for your loyalty to the issue and your commitment to the cause. And I want to thank the Texas Coalition to End the Death Penalty, which is TDCAD, which is AP, which is conducting the demonstration, and Ms. Simmons, who gave us the report from there. Our Sanctoria Panetti, and Victoria Panetti's brother is sitting on death row with severe mental health issues. And this is Execution Watch for January the 26th, 2017. At this point, Mr. Edwards, the subject, is still alive. Thank you.